Welcome to Disruptive Successor, a show for next generation leaders in family businesses and entrepreneurs who want to disrupt the status quo and take their existing business to a whole new level. We all know that what got us here isn't going to get us there. This show will provide inspiration, advice, and resources to help you create massive impact.
This podcast is sponsored by myself, Jonathan Goldhill, and my company, The Goldhill Group, where we provide coaching for growing companies. I'm Jonathan Goldhill, and my purpose is simple: to guide entrepreneurial leaders in family businesses towards more freedom and fulfillment. I want entrepreneurs to get clarity around the changes that will make them and their businesses more successful so they can experience the same freedom I've enjoyed in my life. Our proven practices challenge business owners to think differently about their business and how they're running it, and quite literally become game changers in our clients' companies. Learn more at thegoldhillgroup.com website, where you can schedule your free strategy session.
Hi, it's Jonathan Goldhill, and welcome back to another episode of the Disruptive Successor Show. And today I have a unique individual as my guest. Neil Sahota is an IBM master inventor, a United Nations AI advisor, and author of the book Own the AI Revolution, also a professor at UC Irvine. So today we're going to be talking a lot about innovation, which is so important to family businesses, which is how do you innovate without destroying the business, destroying the baby. So Neil has a really unique experience. He partners with entrepreneurs to define their products, establish their target markets, and structure their companies. He's a member of several investor groups like the Tech Coast Angels. He advises venture capital funds and helped create the UN's Innovation Factory, which is a global program for impact entrepreneurs. Neil, you've got an amazing career. Maybe you want to give the audience a little bit of background about it so people understand the context of where you're coming from.
Sure. Happy to help, Jonathan. I've always been that, ever since I was a little kid, the guy that always wonders, like, how does this work? And more importantly, why do we actually do it this way? So why can we do it differently?
Yeah.
That really led me down actually a career into management consulting, where I work with global Fortune 500 companies. So, you know, I help figure out things like the Disney acquisition of Marvel Comics.
Wow.
Starbucks back to China, except successfully.
Wow.
But that's always kind of things. And it even took me down the path of AI and being part of the original IBM Watson team. So I've always been kind of figuring out what's the next big disruption.
Pretty impressive. We were arguing last night over dinner, like, how many line judges are there in tennis now that Watson has taken over sort of the lines? So AI is a really interesting concept, and I understand it a little bit as an investor, someone who invests in a lot of cutting edge companies. I'm pretty tech heavy, always have been in my investments. Where I've struggled and my clients don't seem to be leaders is how do we innovate in our companies? You know, most people's equity, most families' equity is tied up in their business. And so innovation is maybe like a scary word or a concept. So is there a way to think around innovation that differentiates? I mean, is innovation kind of like leadership and like salespersonship? It's like it's a skill you can learn and develop.
100%. And I think that's what surprises people, that you can actually learn to be innovative. I know for a lot of people, it's hard because we're used to things being a certain way or doing something a certain way, and it works. And nothing's really broken per se. So it's like we never really think about changing it as a result. I always like to use the example of when you drive home from work, do you always use the same route?
Right.
Of course, you know. It works another way. And it's like, well, sometimes you don't take the time to explore. Sometimes you may not find a better way, or you may not find something new, right? Maybe there's something on the way that could use store, restaurant, whatever. You never take the chance to explore. And I think that's a challenge a lot of people have is you're not really born as a great innovator. You can actually learn to be a great innovator, learn to be a great creative thinker. You just never instill the mindset or teach people kind of the tools on how to do that.
So I think of this concept as a little bit like comparing the words efficiency and effectiveness. So you use the example of driving home different routes, and like that's about efficiency. That's about doing things right. So maybe how can we do them faster? But that doesn't lead to like breakthrough thinking. I think you have to look at the whole concept itself and question, for instance, do I need to get from point A to point B? Is there a different way of doing it? I mean, like before Zoom, you might have thought of like astral teleprojection or teleporting, but today you have Zoom and you say, why do I need to fly across the country or even drive, you know, from LA to Orange County, which is a long, you know, 2-hour trip, when we can be on a meeting like this? I mean, I think you have to think about how to break the pattern altogether and focus on effectiveness, which is doing things right, you know, or doing the right thing. Sorry. I mean, so how do you foster innovative thinking in products? Do you have any examples?
Yeah. So this really starts with going away from the mindset of I'm trying to find a way to make it faster, cheaper, or less errors, right? The automation right. side, which is mm-hmm. we're always looking for, the efficiency. To be innovative, we actually have to step back and say, is there a different way of doing this? Can I actually go out of the forest and say, is there a whole different approach to actually do this? And a great example of this is actually with three lawyers. Sorry if people don't love lawyers, but there were three lawyers and I had lunch with them. One of them was an alumnus from UC Irvine. We're just kind of chatting. And at the end, they were kind of talking about AI. And they were like, you know, what's really going on with AI? Is this real? And we're talking about some of the stuff actually happening in the legal industry with, you know, people using AI legal tools for research, managing case rules, you know, the admin, the efficiency stuff. And they're like, okay, so got it. I mean, it doesn't seem that special. I'm like, well, that's the problem. We're so used to automation that everyone's thinking about like AI in terms of automation. No one's driving innovation. Very few companies are actually doing that. They're like, well, what are you talking about? And so I'm like, let's explore it. Like, what's one of the biggest pain points you guys have right now? And they're like, well, there's a lot of admin work. Like someone files a complaint against your client. You know, you have to respond to the complaint, generate deposition questions. You have to do all these things. And I'm like, great. You know, AI can help you do that stuff. What are you talking about? You know, and it actually took them down this path. They went from thinking like, we'll build this tool for our own firm to we can actually turn every firm into our customer. And one of their customers actually is Walmart. And Walmart, ironically, loved the tool, uses it. And they had this case where a guy, ironically, was a dentist, bought a chicken, bit into the gizzard, chipped his tooth on a stone. So he sued Walmart for damages. I don't know what Walmart would normally sell, you know, I don't know, $50,000, $60,000 or something. But because they're using this AI innovation now, you know, called Legalmation, the AI actually, you know, did all the work and it came back and actually said as part of the case strategy that when a chicken eats, it's a material fact that it stores the stones in the gizzard. So the fact that the plaintiff bought the whole chicken, tried to eat the gizzard, should have been aware of the risk. Mm. That argument won Walmart the case. They paid nothing.
Wow.
Right. And it's just like, and we looked and there's nothing about chickens or stones and teaching the AI. And
right.
I talked to some big managing partners, these big law firms, and like, would your guys have figured that out? And they're like, not unless they were chicken farmers.
Exactly. Right. Yeah? So that's pretty interesting. Hey, so let's just go back and forth a little bit here and give examples of where AI is being experienced in everyday life. Because I think a lot of us think of it as a foreign concept. And so while you're thinking about a few, I'm going to start with something that I think is very obvious to me because I'm a shopper on Amazon. And And I see lots of places where Amazon uses AI. And so I start with the concept of personalization, where they seem to know what I like in the way of books, in the way of products, in the way of music. Any way that I interact with them, they know what I like. And so they serve up suggestions when I go to their website to buy a product. Or on Alexa, it'll send me notifications about something that's time to reorder. I know some people don't like Google. They don't like Google following them, but Google knows where I've been, asks me if I'd like to leave a review for a restaurant or a business. Or, you know, I love that they take my photos that I took over years and put them together. They group photos by dogs, by sunrises, by location. I mean, I think that's pretty interesting. Where are you seeing AI that people see it every day and that it's maybe making their lives better, or maybe some people think it's worse?
It's literally everywhere. If you're wondering, if you're on social media, like which TikTok videos you're getting served or what Instagram posts are being pushed to you, that's actually all AI. It's actually has this capability around psychology. We call it psychographics, that through your own actions, it understands who you are, has deciphered your personality traits, your hobbies, your interests. Mm-hmm. It uses that to try and figure out which of these posts, you know, especially from non-connections, would probably interest you the most. Mm-hmm. So we experience that every day. If you're a wine fan, Jonathan, a lot of vineyards are now using AI technology, not just to try and figure out what's the right wine to pair for you, but actually like using AI robots out in the vineyards. And they can actually look at the grapes and say, okay, this one's ready to be picked. This one's not ready to be picked. If we give it another 6 days, it'll be better. So I'll tag this in my mind and come back. And so that's the extent we're actually seeing AI in wine even.
Wow. Yeah, I saw it also in early on in the landscape industry when I first got involved in the landscape industry by writing a marketing plan for the release of a controller system. And a controller is basically the clock that turns on and off your sprinkler systems. But this one, it could know what was going on in the microclimate at your building or your house or your property. It would detect flow leaks and be able to alert you in those things. And like that was pretty amazing. And you could control the clock or controller remotely through your cell phone, through an app. Pretty amazing.
Well, and this is the power, right? And I think a lot of people think, okay, there's some amazing tools and capabilities here, but I'm not Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos, right? What does it really mean for me? I have to wait for someone to figure out the tool, right, that I can use for my business. And the honest truth is, that's actually not the way successful AI solutions come about. Mm-hmm. They come about from people like the three lawyers that knew a pain point, right, and try to solve it. It's about understanding all of these capabilities, but it's about shifting the mindset here.
Yeah.
There are a lot of smart technologists. They don't know the problems of a lawyer or a marketer or a doctor or a financial analyst. That's why we actually each have the power to be innovators. We just haven't learned to tap into that. But I think through like your book and, you know, stuff that I've done and other people have done, we can actually turn everyone into a disruptor.
Wow. So can we train even managers at companies to think disruptively without, I mean, I know we as coaches recommend an exercise. I mean, one is the SWOT analysis, where you ask the managers what are our strengths and weaknesses, what are the opportunities and threats, and then we try and do some business planning or visioning around it. And we also have a start, stop, keep, or continue exercise where we're asking them things like, what should we start doing? What should we stop doing? And so, are we seeing innovation at the management level in small and medium sized enterprises?
Yeah, we are and we can. I mean, I use something called Tuckbo. It's a process model I created through my own work. And Tuckbo really stands for think different, understand different, create different, be different, own different. Mm. Soup to nuts, from ideation to market validation to how to actually build, design, launch, and build the infrastructure and buy-in. It's something that's been, I've actually been able to teach to people, and actually they've been actually able to repeat it on their own.
Hmm. Is it something that they do sequentially, or is it something that you're doing all, you know, all those think, understand, be, are you doing them all simultaneously? How does it work?
The be and own happen at the same time. The others come before, right? You have the idea, the validation. But like I was talking about, like Legalmation, that's exactly the framework that I was able to teach them. They were actually able to employ. I mean, no offense to lawyers out there, they're very linear thinkers.
Yes.
They're not known for innovation, but they were actually able to learn this and apply it. Well, it's the same way I was able to take like Starbucks to China, but I was able to teach their, not just their executives, but their first line managers. And this actually led them to coming up with some ideas on how to actually improve their loyalty program.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, I think what shocks a lot of people is that they think you're kind of born this great creative thinker.
Right.
Not at all. Everyone has the power to actually do it. We just never teach that to people.
Yeah, well, I think it's a difficult thing to teach. It seems like it starts with maybe just some creativity workshops. I mean, decades ago, there was a book called Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain, and it was trying to get people to think about being not just a left brain thinker, but being a right brain, holistic thinker. I mean, is that where it starts? Like being just trying to do things creatively?
Yeah, it's tapping the creative side, but it's also kind of shifting the mindset. Like, let's be honest, most people, we hate change, right?
Yep,
exactly. And so someone throws out an idea, our first reaction is to figure out why it won't work. You know, well, you can't do this, or you've never done that. You want to unlock innovation, you have to shift that and say, rather than why won't this work, start thinking like, well, how would I make this work? Even if it was a crazy idea, you go down this path, right? Because then it puts you in this mindset. You start exploring, and maybe you don't figure out a way to make it work, and that's okay. You tried. But if you go in with a mindset, okay, how would I try and make this work? You're actually then trying to figure out the path. And then you're going to say, okay, wait, there's a way to do this. Is this viable? Is it value added, right? It starts taking you down this different chain of events that normally happens.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Interesting. You know, I work, Neil, with a lot of family-owned businesses. A lot of them are in the construction space. They're doing roofing, they're doing landscaping, and many of them see the business as what it is. It's something that doesn't involve much artificial intelligence. There is something you talk about artistic intelligence in your or your backdrop there. AI for good, artistic intelligence. I think there are people who are landscapers, roofers, contractors in general, who see the world through a slightly different lens. And, you know, they can look at a piece of property and in their mind's eye, they can envision what would be a very beautiful landscape. I think that's artistic intelligence, but it's probably not artificial intelligence. It's natural intelligence. Any thoughts for these contractors on how they can have more of a innovative mindset, a disruptive thinking mindset?
I think it really starts with understanding your customer and understanding that there's something different you can do. You know, there's a real example where a friend of a friend, you know, owned a nice like restaurant bar type of place. And at the time, he was struggling to get younger people in. He wanted to get like more college people, more working professionals. And, you know, you try promotions, you try all the normal things, and it didn't really take much effect. And, you know, I was chatting with him. And so actually, again, playing, talk about the think different, kind of reoriented and said, rather than do all these things to try to target these different segments, you know, you want this one segment. What are those people doing, right? If they're not coming to your restaurant, what are they actually doing? And he's like, well, I think they're probably going to some other restaurant or something like that. And I was like, well, what if they're not going to a restaurant at all? And so we actually started exploring this, and we started looking at their hobbies and their interests. And, you know, at the time, Pokemon Go was really a big craze. And what we found out was that this core segment he's trying to get are playing this game constantly. Well, we learned that you could actually buy these Pokemon monsters, including the rare ones, and put them inside the restaurant. Mm. So now you have all these people who are playing this game that if they want these creatures actually have to come inside, sit down, order food, right? And they can fight, get the monster, whatever. Mm-hmm. Well, that turned out to be wildly successful for him. You know, get the people in the door, they provide great service, great quality of food, they got people to start coming back, right? He's like, wow, I never would have dreamed that I could use a video game to drive my business.
Crazy, right? And yeah. So what I'm hearing from you is that the process could begin with getting close to your customers and really finding out their psychological desires or needs or wants and trying to serve up something that aligns with that psychological or psychographic and bring them in through that.
100%. It's pains and gains and knowing what your customers want to do. That's really the ultimate thing here. We like to think that we know the customers and we've been in business for a long time, but you know, people change, market conditions change. We got to be ready to adapt to that.
Yeah, but so like you're asking someone who might not even know what questions to go and ask. I mean, like, I don't know how you uncovered that they all liked that game. It was hot. It was, you know, but it takes a certain mindset probably just to be able to ask the right questions of your customers. I mean, what would be, where would you start them? Would they start by asking psychographic questions, or would they start by asking, you know, what do you like about our product or service? What needs does it fulfill? What's missing? Why do you go somewhere else? You know, what are you seeing in the market? Where would you start?
Those are all great questions, but I would even take it back a step further to where you start. Just say, who is the customer, mm-hmm. right? Forget about your product or service for a moment, but say, who is the customer? What is it they do and where are they? Right? If yeah. you don't understand that, you don't know where to find them and you don't know what they're doing, right? A lot of people, I hate to say it, in this information age, expect you to know them. They're like, there's so much information about me. Especially for millennials, Generation Z, they're like, you should already know me. You should already know what I would want. To talk to me, all these things. And that's tough for small businesses in particular. Mm-hmm. Right? We don't have all these amazing tools and ways to dissect all this information. But it's still possible to do it, you know, with 20th century techniques. It's just we got to start with who is the customer. Not necessarily why they need my product or they're not using my product, who product they're using, just who are they?
Yeah. So in your involvement in the venture community, specifically when you're like advising clients, how often are you having them rethink their business model, their product or service just entirely? Like, is that a common conversation?
It is. I mean, honestly, Jonathan, it probably happens about 70% of the time.
Wow. Isn't that easy when they're just starting? I mean, they're not too far in. I mean, the more deeply embedded, the number more years or months they've been at it, I imagine the more resistant they are to talking about changing it.
Unfortunately, you're quite correct there, Jonathan. Mm-hmm. But that's the common problem that we see with a lot of entrepreneurs. Or even, you know, people that have small businesses is that, again, they look at it and think, okay, but this is what I would want, right? I know the space really well. Mm-hmm. I probably know the customer. And that's really not the case at all. There's too much diversity and other things going on. Or they're like, I've got several loyal customers. I'll ask them. Well, they're a bit biased.
Right.
That's the challenge. Look at real estate. I hear a lot of people, especially, they go back to the early 2000s, they're like, getting to real estate, they're like, well, I'll buy a property and rent it out. It's like, I understand real estate. I live in a home or I rent an apartment. It's like, that's not understanding the business. That's not understanding the customer. Right? You might be a really great homeowner or a really great tenant. That doesn't mean other people are like that. And I think a lot of people learn the lesson the hard way. So at the end of the day, your business is not there to build the product that you want. It's really there to give the product your customer needs. And I think that's where I see a lot of the struggle is you think like, well, I would use my product, but that doesn't make you the right customer.
Yeah. Interesting. You know, because some companies are founded around a charismatic leader who bases his or her decisions based on what they would want. There's almost an arrogance about it. I think Steve Jobs is coming to my mind at the forefront of someone who basically created stuff that he thinks would be great. And because look, if 20 years ago someone said, and I think they did, like, I'm going to create a device, it's going to be something you can hold in your hand, it'll have, you know, thousands of songs on it, and you'll be able to access your calendar and some other really cool apps, and you'll be able to do email off of it, you might have said, but I don't need anything like that. That's ridiculous. So that's a different level of innovation, someone who's on kind of the bleeding edge. I mean, we're not necessarily talking about bleeding edge thinking here. We're talking about just somewhat disruptive to the status quo. Am I right? Do I have this just, you know?
100%. I know a lot of people talk about the out-of-the-box thinking, Jonathan. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's opportunities out there, but there's a lot more opportunities, what I call around the box.
Right.
Right? Look at the surface of the box. There's actually stuff there, and that's a lot more attainable, a lot more visible.
Right.
Right? It's just, again, we don't teach people to think that way. They're like, well, that next great disruptive innovation is going to be way out there.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? It actually just may be on the surface of the box here.
Yeah, are you familiar with Salim Ismail from Singularity University, I think it's called?
I know Singularity University. I'm not familiar with this person, though.
Yeah, I think he's the founder of it. I've not participated, but the concept is that he's teaching you how to 10x or find your 10x factor, and that requires super disruptive thinking. I've known some people who've had those aha moments, where, as an example, someone realized that instead of taking so many weeks to get out to a person's home to give them a quote on having their lawn or their landscaping redone, they used early AI technology, such as what was around, you know, Google Earth, to sort of visually see the dimensions of the property. They can use computer-aided design to basically pop in what landscaping might look like once it's completed. And they could quote over the phone literally minutes after the inquiry came in instead of weeks. And so that was a 10x game changer for that company. But these are, you know, it's tough to find these things, I think. So is there an aha moment that someone has, or are you saying you can teach people how to have like consecutive aha moments? How does it work, Neil?
You know, Jonathan, I'm not sure I believe in aha moments. I
think
realizations we come up with build from small things we experience or we observe. And at some point we actually manage to connect the dots together. It's a question of how fast we can connect the dots. Mm-hmm. And I think we can teach people to connect them faster. Like, you know, our home is on the older side and, you know, foundation settling stuff, but we have cracks in the drywalls because of age and stuff. And so, you know, brought in a little home contractor doing some work. And I was just talking to him about it. He's like, yeah, it's common with houses, you know, especially around this age. And so I was like, oh, so you must be getting a lot of work around here. He's like, well, what are you talking about? I'm like, well, all the homes in this track are built at the same time.
Right.
And you can see more like,
huh. I thought about that.
Yeah, I didn't think about that. So I was like, oh, you're have you considered reaching out to some of the people around here, maybe doing some targeted advertising? He's like, that's actually a really good idea. You know, and you kind of see, you know, the light bulb going off, but this is him connecting all these dots he had stacked up over, you know, time through experience and stuff.
Right. So, you know, as I'm thinking about this, I'm thinking like, so a CEO and his or her team, should they go off to their CEO cave and try and figure this out? Should they, sounds like they need to get closer to their customer. Do they, you know, how do they engage their team in having this kind of innovation mindset? I mean, isn't this better off as a group think? Or a group exercise? Group think might boil it down to something that they think is too practical. Are you looking to try and get people to figure out how to have a, you say not aha, but maybe a BHAG moment where they think, like, you know, what could we do that would be like radically different and better? And, you know, should we do it as a group, figure this out? What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I believe in diversity of thought, and having a group with diverse perspectives, I think, always helps. I know for some small businesses, that's a bit of a challenge. It doesn't mean you can't do it by yourself, but if you have the opportunity, tap into that. And if you're worried about groupthink and not, you know, thinking a little more towards the edge of the box there, I like to use something called the 10th person rule, which means that, you know, if nine people come to the same conclusion, the 10th person has to come up with something completely different.
Okay.
That forces creativity and it forces different thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, I used to use an exercise back in the 90s with clients where we would have them identify their competitors and identify the nine things that the competitors do that's the same as everyone else in the industry, and then think about what's your 10th thing. What the 10th thing being, you know, something that might tip the scale, you know, push a wedge between you and all your competitors and separate them. Now, that's not AI. It's not, but it was using competitive thinking and analysis. I think what's really interesting to me is like, so how do you dominate a market? Clearly you dominate a market if you have a product that's completely different. And it's a game changer.
But that's the simple way of looking at it. But there's other ways to compete, right, Jonathan? You can look and say, well, maybe my product is really more the it factor. It carries a certain premium quality to it or a certain status to it. Right? There's lots of ways to skin the cat, to be cliche.
Mm-hmm.
It's just finding what connects again with your customers. Who are they and what do they care about?
Mm-hmm. So tell our listeners a little bit about your firm. What kind of work do you do? You have an advisory firm, it seems like, and you're teaching. Tell us a little bit about what kind of clients you're working with. What's a great engagement? What's the process look like?
I work with a lot of different types of clients. So from small startup companies to big Fortune 500 companies, as well as nonprofit and government agencies. It's all about them kind of unlocking the innovation, get them beyond the automation and find that disruptive opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it's kind of working through Tuckbo. And again, it's not just coming up with the idea, it's how to actually execute against it successfully. And that's the other struggle. Once you have a great idea, how do you actually make it a reality?
Mm-hmm.
So it's teaching them how to do this. It's kind of helping them through that first opportunity to get the immersive hands-on experience, and that they can actually go out and keep doing it on their own.
Hmm. Interesting. And you're working with social enterprises as well, where and let's define for people to understand what a social enterprise is, but that seems like a great place for, let's call it artistic intelligence.
So I do. It's a big passion. So for people that may not be familiar with social enterprise, they're for-profit businesses that also are focused on a positive impact. Like you think of like Tom's Shoes. If you buy a pair of Tom's Shoes, they donate a pair of shoes to someone in need.
Mm-hmm.
It's things like that. And I'm very big about that because my goal in life is to try and leave the world at least as good as I found it, if not better.
Yeah. I like that.
Yeah. And social enterprise, again, it's a different type of mindset, right? We're used to for-profit or nonprofit.
Right.
And we don't think about, can you do both? That was an interesting disruption in the corporate model when it first happened.
Yeah, well, you know, and I know many years ago, and it seems like you're involved in incubators as well. So back in the 90s, I was involved in researching the establishment of some incubators, and I was involved in running an incubator, basically. But I think that's a very interesting concept. Incubators are basically places where small startup businesses would go and would get shared services, really discounted rent, access to experts like yourself and myself, access to maybe capital through their network. So, and other shared services that would reduce their operating expenses. I think of like a great social enterprise in the Los Angeles area, maybe one of the largest, is Homeboy Industries. Homeboy is based in the hood. I think it's either Compton or Watts, South Central Los Angeles. And they've got a bakery. They're producing just really cool baked goods. And the people that are working there, I think a lot of them are ex-cons that basically were in the prison system and couldn't get jobs. And so they were put into this enterprise. And so I'm not sure if it's run as a nonprofit or as a for-profit. I think it's a nonprofit, but with a goal of making money, but it's basically set up as a training ground for people to get reintegrated into the workforce, get jobs, teach other people how to do jobs. And boy, if that isn't some disruptive thinking about, you know, I mean, getting people back into the workforce, I don't know what is. Pretty powerful.
100%. But that's again, thinking differently. That's the, yeah, the mantra here. There's so many opportunities like this. There's an organization called Dana that they wanted to help upskill underserved communities so they could get ready for, you know, the STEM jobs, the jobs of tomorrow. And they're trying to figure out how to do this and how to build a partnership with people that are experienced so they can work side by side when you get projects.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, we were talking through this and came up with a great idea that, well, if you need projects, could you help nonprofits, right? Help do something for a nonprofit where they get these teams of volunteers, experienced, unexperienced, and you get someone to sponsor the project. That's worked out really well. I think they've been doing this for about 3 years and there are over 50 projects.
I think it's great. These kinds of thinking, you know, what Tom did in Tom's Shoes, what Homeboy's doing, what this group is doing, I think it creates an affinity for your brand that you have maybe a cause or a give back or something that, again, separates you. Because in a lot of industries, we can easily get commoditized. And, you know, 9 out of 10 things we do is the same as everyone else. We got to find that 10th thing. And if you focus on the 10th thing, then suddenly maybe it's 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. There's a half a dozen things that you do differently. And your brand now experiences some real lift because your experience is different in the marketplace, not just the same.
100%. And you get the added bonus that young millennials of Generation Z are very values aligned.
Yep.
So we talked about who is your customer. They care about these types of things. They'll actually pay a premium to use your product or service for that very reason. And if you want to get the top talent, that's what they look at. You know, yeah. I work for a company that believes like I do.
Do you think that as we start to wrap up here, I'm wondering whether the Fortune 500, let's just call them the large corporations, are they paying more homage, getting more involved in disruptive thinking, or is the small, do we leave it to the small business, or is it just in the hands of like the entrepreneurs who are venture backed and trying to be real disruptive, or is it just across the board everywhere?
Well, it's across the board, but it's skewed. It's skewed more towards the small business and the entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to say it, that the big businesses, while they want to be, they're not as willing to take the risks and put the investment into it. Again, they got something that works. They're used to it. They make money. They're afraid of rattling things up. The problem, though, is, you know, my buddy Peter DeMonte said it really well. If you're not trying to Uber yourself, you're going to get Kodak'd. And if you're not trying to figure out a way to disrupt your own business, someone will disrupt you.
Yeah. Yeah. Look at, I love Netflix as an example. Blockbuster. I had an opportunity to buy Netflix for like a really cheap price. And they thought, you know, streaming, no one's going to want streaming. Well, boy, did they were on the wrong side of that decision. And so, yeah, very interesting. Neil Sahota. So people can get a hold of you through, what's the best way to reach you? Is it through LinkedIn, through your website,
email? Yeah, you can follow me on LinkedIn or Twitter. I do share and post often. I do post a lot of my current work on my website. So if you're always wondering what I'm up to, you can look up me there as well as contact me through my website. I love to hear from people. And if you get inspired to think differently, come up with something disruptive from Jonathan's show, drop us a line and we'd love to hear about it.
Great. So Disruptive Successors, you heard it here first. Contact Neil Sahota with, and it's your email is Neil at ACKI USA Advisory. ACKI, is that right?
It is, but keep it simple for everybody. There's a simple contact form on my website. So
fantastic.
Much easier way to do it.
And we'll have your contact information in the show notes. Neil, thanks so much for being on the show today. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. If you like this, share this, start thinking disruptively, and innovate. Thanks for joining us on the show today, Neil.
My pleasure.
This podcast is sponsored by myself, Jonathan Goldhill, and my company, the Goldhill Group, where we provide coaching for growing companies. I'm Jonathan Goldhill, and my purpose is simple: to guide entrepreneurial leaders in family businesses towards more freedom and fulfillment. I want entrepreneurs to get clarity around the changes that will make them and their businesses more successful so they can experience the same freedom I've enjoyed in my life. Our proven practices challenge business owners to think differently about their business and how they're running it, and quite literally become game changers in our clients' companies. Learn more at thegoldhillgroup.com website, where you can schedule your free strategy session.
Thank you for joining us on the Disruptive Successor Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe, review, and share with a friend who would benefit from the message. If you're interested in picking up a copy of my book, Disruptive Successor, go to disruptivesuccessor.com.